Revisiting the ransom question today, Tuesday, August 26th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Lots of tough questions still about the Western hostages held by radical militants inside Syria. The thorniest question remains, who pays ransoms and who doesn't? One former captive says the truth doesn't even matter sometimes.
You know, whether or not a ransom is actually paid, the problem is that kidnappers in the region, these militant groups, are going to believe that a ransom was paid.
Also today, why the United Arab Emirates went against U.S. wishes to bomb targets inside Libya. Plus, Canadians contemplate a future in which their beloved Tim Hortons is owned by Burger King.
For a lot of people, thinking that it's going to be going into American hands and whether that'll change the image of the company or, God forbid, change the kind of coffee they're drinking, that's what people are talking about.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
It's Marco Werman here, and this is The World. 3 years ago, U.S. airstrikes helped topple Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. But now, Washington does not want to get involved, as the post-revolution chaos in Libya threatens to become a full-blown civil war. And it doesn't want others to intervene either. Trouble is, others have intervened. Egypt and the United Arab Emirates reportedly worked together to launch airstrikes against Islamist militias in Libya, not once, but twice, over the past week. New York Times correspondent David Kirkpatrick just got back to Cairo from an assignment to Tripoli, and he says it's surprising that the strikes happened at all.
It's really quite striking, almost shocking, that Egypt and the Emirates, two really very close allies of the United States and military partners, conducted these strikes without telling Washington. Washington was caught by surprise, and they did it twice. You know, it's one thing to think, okay, we'll sneak this one by. But you would imagine that they would guess that Washington would be watching closely when a week later they conducted a second set of airstrikes launched out of Egypt with Emirati planes targeting Tripoli.
And so why did the United States not get warned about these airstrikes?
Well, the United States is still hoping, along with the Western powers in Europe, to broker a peaceful resolution in Libya. So if they'd gone to the United States would have said, no, or please don't do this. Then you have to add to that the fact that there's been a growing gulf of distrust between Egypt, the Emirates, and Saudi Arabia on the one hand, and the United States on the other, in the aftermath of the Arab Spring. The United States really embraced these democratic movements even when they brought Islamists to power, and that is something which is anathema to the governments of Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia today.
So how does that orient the U.S. now, and which side basically is the U.S. on?
Well, I think the U.S. does not want to take a side in this particular regional battle, and the U.S. continues to hope that things will stabilize. But there are obviously forces pulling in several directions at once, and I'm not sure how American policymakers think they're going to steer through these waters. Certainly, on the ground here, everyone is full of conspiracy theories about which side the Americans are truly on.
And given how much military aid the United States gives to Egypt, could it be possible that U.S. weapons were involved in these airstrikes? And what does that signify?
Yeah, I couldn't get a straight answer from the U.S. officials that I talked to about what weapons were used, which I think it will raise some eyebrows in Washington if it turns out that these strikes were conducted across borders between countries in the Middle East against U.S. policy, but with U.S. weapons.
So civil war in Libya, I mean, is the country just undoing everything it gained after the Arab Spring?
Well, the situation is bad. It's certainly dark. And yet, if you want to be hopeful, you can say that Libya has successfully overthrown a brutal and capricious tyrant who governed the country. I shouldn't even say governed the country, who ruled the country in a kind of mafia-like fashion for over 40 years. That's an achievement. And the chaos that has followed is arguably a consequence of his 40-year rule rather than anything else. And it may just be a long, dark, and painful period that Libya has to get through if they hope to really build a modern state.
So what's next? Will these bombing campaigns continue?
That's a good question. I imagine not. It seems like the Emiratis and the Egyptians hoped or believed they could do this discreetly and covertly enough that no one would know. If they continue at this point, there's likely to be a regional diplomatic backlash and certainly an escalation in support for the other side of the Libyan conflict.
There are not many Western journalists on the ground in Tripoli. You may have been the only one. What is it like there on the ground? Are you free to walk around? Does it feel like a civil war is going on in the country?
It does feel very much like a civil war is going on in the country. I think as a Libyan, there's a pretty large portions of the city where you're free to walk around. As me, I'm not as free to walk around because I'm afraid of being kidnapped, which I very much do not want.
David Kirkpatrick with the New York Times. Thanks very much.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Another Gulf nation, Qatar, is in the spotlight this week for its role in negotiating the release of Peter Theo Curtis. He's the American writer who was held by militants in Syria for nearly 2 years. And one lingering question regarding his release is whether a ransom was paid. The U.S. government rejects ransom payments, but other nations have been reported to pay for the release of their captured citizens. In the Curtis case, a White House spokesman strongly denied any suggestion of a ransom.
The United States government certainly did not ask the Qataris to pay a ransom. In fact, we asked the Qataris, consistent with our longstanding policy, to not pay a ransom for Mr. Curtis.
But that's not the message militants are hearing, according to David Rode. He's the former New York Times reporter who was held captive by the Taliban a few years back. He's now with Reuters, and last week we checked in with him after the execution of another American hostage in Syria, James Foley. I spoke with David Rode again today.
You know, whether or not a ransom was actually paid, the problem is that kidnappers in the region, these militant groups, are going to believe that a ransom was paid. When I was in captivity many years ago, 5 years ago with the Taliban, Captain Phillips, in this famous raid off the coast of Somalia, was rescued by the U.S. Navy SEALs. The Taliban commander who kidnapped me listened to a report on the BBC Pashto service, the local language service, and just shook his head when this description of the raid was on the radio. And he just said that raid never happened. That's a fiction the U.S. government created. You know, I know the American government actually paid some huge ransom in secret. So, you know, I still think people who do these things are going to think a huge ransom was paid and will try to kidnap other foreigners.
What do you think is the relationship between the episode in which journalist James Foley was executed last week and the release of Theo Curtis? Is there any?
I think there's a very good chance that Jim Foley may have saved Theo Curtis's life. Theo Curtis was held by a different group from Jim Foley, and I think it put a lot of pressure on Qatar to show that it could have influence on this group that had Theo Curtis and it could get him out. There was suddenly some urgency and a desire for a positive story for Qatar and for the U.S.
Well, let's talk about Qatar's role, because it seems that it was Samantha Power, U.S. ambassador to the U.N., who introduced Theo Curtis's family to her counterpart in Qatar to help negotiate his release. How common is that?
Families go to every American official they can. I know the Foleys in particular talked to different American diplomats, including Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. at the time. So that's not unusual. What is unusual, what deserves more focus, is Qatar. And, you know, there have been reports for a long time that Qatar was essentially backing this group. It's called the Nusra Front. It's a jihadist group. It's allied with al-Qaeda. It's slightly less extreme than the group that killed Jim Foley. You know, the Qatari government denies it, but there's this long history of countries, including the U.S., you know, using proxies. The U.S. had jihadis fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. We learned what a disaster that was, that you don't control these groups, that these groups become Frankensteins. But I'm afraid that Qatar hasn't learned this lesson. Saudi Arabia is said to fund some jihadi groups that they think can counter, you know, Iran and achieve its goals. And of course, Pakistan has a long history of, you know, working with the Afghan Taliban. And it's a disastrous policy. So I want to know why Qatar was suddenly able to get these jihadists to free Theo. I'm glad they did, but, you know, they have apparently a great deal of influence.
I mean, do you have any idea what is in this deal for Qatar?
You know, it's a positive. It shows the U.S. they can produce, that they can control their proxies. These captors held him for 2 years. And these are, you know, small groups. They spent a lot of time having guards around him 24/7. They fed him. There's like an amount of money that they invest in holding a captive for so long. So I do not know if a ransom was paid, but if there wasn't, you know, Qatar exerted a huge amount of pressure to get these groups to just release him.
If we believe the White House line that there was no ransom paid, what do you think's in it for the Nusra Front to just let Theo Curtis go without getting anything apparently solid in return?
Nothing. Either something was paid or Qatar has very powerful links and a certain degree of influence and even control of the Nusra Front, a group aligned with al-Qaeda. Qatar has to answer some questions here.
Journalist David Rode with Reuters, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
How important is your first cup of coffee of the day? Mine is crucial. I didn't have one at home yesterday, and it completely threw me off my game. So imagine what a rough day it's been for Canadians. They woke up to the news that their favorite coffee chain, Tim Hortons, was bought by Burger King. They paid $11 billion for the coffee and donut chain, making Burger King now the world's third biggest fast food chain. Tim Hortons is as Canadian as Mounties and hockey. In fact, it's come to represent the true nature of the country.
Give me two coffees.
$3.50, please. Hey, what'd you think of the game last night?
What game?
The Leafs beat Edmonton?
Yes, I missed it.
Oh, sorry, you're American. Here's your change.
I'm not American.
American money? Didn't watch the Leafs game? No, please or thank you for the coffee. You sure don't seem like a Canadian.
Yeah, just for the record, you'll get please and thank you for me. Thank you very much. A scene there from the CBS comedy How I Met Your Mother, set in a Tim Hortons, that scene. Katya Dmitrieva is a Toronto-based reporter for Bloomberg News. So what is the big deal about Tim Hortons? Why is this such a sea change up there?
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show. And you can tell I'm Canadian just from that. It's massive because this is your daily cup of coffee. You go in the morning, you get your medium double-double or double cream, double sugar. For a lot of people, thinking that it's going to be going into American hands and whether that'll change the image of the company or, God forbid, change the kind of coffee they're drinking. That's what people are talking about.
So you spent some time in a food court speaking with people about the deal. What are Canadians saying?
Well, Canadians are very concerned. There were a few people I spoke with who didn't even want to go on the record because they were so vehemently opposed to an American company buying out this icon as they see it. There were two women I spoke with in particular who, one of them has been drinking the same coffee for four decades, and she goes there every day and she has her cup of coffee. The idea that that may change or that an American company may come in and shake things up and look for ways to cut costs, whether it's changing the image, changing the staffing, changing the blend, it's got people really riled up. Tim Hortons has been around since the 60s. He's a hockey player, and it started as one location that served donuts and coffee. And now it's expanded to thousands of stores worldwide, most of them in Canada. It's grown with the country. That's another thing that people mentioned is this company is always adapting, right? So if people are writing in a lot and saying, you know, we want our panini sandwich or we want chili or we want something else, you know, the company is always adapting to that. That's what I heard.
So the reaction in Canada, would you say it's more about kind of fear of change and this and these Tim Horton loyalists who don't want their coffee to taste any different than it does today? Or is it a reaction that's kind of a patriotic reaction against Americans coming in and taking over?
It is patriotism for sure. This is one of the last remaining brands that we have that are Canadian. And I think people are feeling really riled up by that, especially folks who have grown up with this brand all their lives. You go to a small town in Canada, whether it's in Ontario or British Columbia, any province, and that's where you have, I think, the most loyal people. You have truckers, they're going through the drive-thru at Tim Hortons. You see construction workers in Toronto on their break eating sandwiches and drinking a coffee or an ice cap in the summer. This is an institution. So a lot of it is, you know, this is Canadian, this is ours, hands off. The other side of it is also, you know, why? It's because we love the brand and we love the coffee and we love the food and we love the service and we do not want that to change.
Katya Dmitrieva, a Toronto-based reporter with Bloomberg News. She's been writing about the purchase of Canadian coffee chain Tim Hortons by Burger King. Katya, keep hope alive.
Thanks a lot, eh?
Well, maple syrup and snow is what they export. They treat curling just like it's a real sport. They think their silly accent is so cute. Can't understand a thing they're talking about.
Still ahead on the world. The first mosque in Alaska. No dome, though. It's not good under snow. On PRI. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. No summer would be complete without a field trip. I got mine in this morning along with the world's history guy Chris Wolf and intern Michelle Harvin. We went down to the Museum of Fine Arts here in Boston to get an up-close look at the Magna Carta. Yep, the Magna Carta, that really old English document that inspired our Constitution and Bill of Rights. And I mean really old. There are only 4 copies of the Magna Carta left in the world. As we walked into the gallery, Chris was the first one to spot it.
And there it is. It's tiny.
I was going to say, I mean, my eyes were drawn to this room, and suddenly in the back of it is this piece of paper that looks like the size of a placemat.
Yeah, like 20 inches by 20 inches square, with like little small writing on it that I'm going to have to get my glasses to read. And even then, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to make out many of the words.
So we're talking to a man, Chris Wolf, who grew up not far from where this thing was signed. And you're seeing this for the first time, the original, not a replica. This is the first time you're seeing it.
That's right. And that's pretty cool. That's 800 years old. Well, 799. But once you get past 798, who's counting? And it's a very clear script. I'd be pretty impressed if a scribe could do that nowadays. It's all in Latin, of course, Magna Carta, it's the Great Charter.
And Carta actually even goes, the root would be paper, right? Cartelleria in Italian, I mean, so it's like giant paper.
Yeah, in a sense, but that's literally, it was a formal piece of paper, like a document, a charter. And this is the Great Charter because it was the first, and many people argue, the most important document in constitutional history.
So what is the story of the Magna Carta? I mean, when was it written? Why was it written?
Well, 15th of June, 1215, if you can imagine. That's almost 800 years ago. And it was basically a bunch of revolting nobles forced the king, bad King John. Remember King John from the Robin Hood movies? Same guy. And basically cajoled and bullied him into signing this charter, which gave away a lot of his powers and privileges to the nobles, or at least codified it. It's interesting how they kind of exploited history, the nobles, to try and justify what they were doing by harking back to an older golden age and some previous documents that had been signed. Like in 1100, there was a Charter of Liberties that King Henry I issued when he was coronated. So they used that kind of strong-arm the king into giving away these powers.
Yeah, what kind of powers, Chris? And what exactly does this say in relation to those powers?
Well, scholars have broken it down into several dozen clauses or chapters, but I think the most important ones are the things that it's basically saying that the king, the executive power in the land, is subject to the law as well, that everybody is subject to the law, that you can't be imprisoned, outlawed, exiled, you can't have your property taken away except by due process of law.
I mean, I grew up learning that the Magna Carta was kind of the precursor to the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. Is it perceived in the UK in the same way as like the British document where everything started?
It's very interesting, the differences here and in the UK. The MFA, where we're standing, has the title of the exhibit as the Inspiration for the Founding Fathers. And in the UK, I don't know, you grew up so surrounded by history. I grew up just a little couple of miles from Runnymede. Runnymede is the little place where it was sound. It literally means it's the wet meadow by the banks of the Thames. And you go play there amongst all the monuments that are there now. It's still a big meadow, which is great because it's just not far from London. But there's monuments from all kinds of constitutional groups in America that have gone over and built these memorials. Because really it is, for many scholars, English scholars as well would say, this is probably the founding document for what we consider modern Western constitutional government, that there are limits on power and limits on what kings and princes and presidents can do.
So what's it like for you to see this thing for the first time? How are you feeling right now, considering you romped around all these kind of historical monuments not far from where this was signed?
I'm pretty blown away, actually. I didn't think I was going to be too excited because it's just a thing. I've always been interested more in history for ideas. And then physically to see the document that King John and those nobles put the royal seal to and their own signatures on, it's pretty amazing. I should say there were about 40 to 50 copies made, one for the Royal Archives, one for the City of London, I believe, and one for every county in the realm at that time.
I think back, you know, to the Declaration of Independence and how it is now evoked by politicians. That's not what the Founding Fathers intended. Do British politicians kind of look back at the Magna Carta and say, oh, we can't do X, Y, or Z because that's not what the Founding Fathers intended?
Well, interestingly, they used to. It was huge, like, for the first century after it was signed. It was used all the time. And then it kind of fell into the background a little bit. But when it really comes into its own is the end of the Tudors and the beginning of the Stuart era, when the kings of the realm are trying to push back and claim more of the royal prerogative, trying to grab back absolute power for the monarchy, like happened in France. And the Puritans are leading the charge against the royal power. And, of course, the Puritans, because they didn't like it, one of their choices was to leave. And where did they go? Boston. So there's kind of a nice kind of circle there that they brought with them, that passion that was prevalent in England at the time.
And the fact is, we are at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. I mean, take off your history hat for a moment and put on your art critic hat. Even if you don't have one, put it on. You think it's beautiful? I mean, what's your kind of overall appreciation of this as a piece of fine art?
Well, my nickname at college was the Cultural Desert, so I don't know how much of an art critic we could say. But it looks like ancient parchment paper. Paper until the 19th century was designed to last forever. Modern paper will just disintegrate after 100 years or so. But you can see it's still there. It's very tightly spaced lines. There's almost no punctuation except for occasionally you'll see one big capital letter standing out every five lines or so. And otherwise, it's just like James Joyce's Ulysses, just a long stream of script that just goes on and on, enouncing different liberties. And I have to go back to the history thing, though. It's the real moving thing is like what it embodies in terms of like freedom.
Yeah, elaborate on that. What does it embody? For you, I mean, just at a personal level.
Well, isn't it great that I can own a house and you can't be turned out of it willy-nilly unless there's, you know, you go through the due process of the law that, you know, I only pay taxes by my consent. You know, there's so many principles in there that, you know, just make life so worth living.
Chris Wolfe, the World's History Guy, thanks for coming down to the museum today.
You're welcome.
The Magna Carta is on display at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston through Labor Day. And by the way, the exhibit also includes handwritten drafts of the Declaration of Independence from Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. It's all really cool stuff. Anyway, to take us to the break, what better than a bit of Monty Python to illustrate just how reverently some Brits view their constitutional history?
Will I become king then?
The Lady of the Lake, her arm clad in the purest shimmering samite, held aloft Excalibur from the bosom of the water, signifying by divine providence that I, Arthur, was to carry Excalibur. That is why I'm your king.
Listen, strange women lying in ponds, distributing swords is no basis for a system of government. Supreme executive power derives from a mandate from the masses, not from some farcical aquatic ceremony. Be quiet!
Meep? An excerpt from Monty Python and the Holy Grail, in case you were wondering. News headlines are just ahead. This is The World on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, a filmmaker remembers an encounter at a Dunkin' Donuts in Saudi Arabia.
This group of little girls ran into the Dunkin' Donuts because they wanted to get some donuts, and they had to stop at the door because there were two men sitting next to me in the Dunkin' Donuts eating their donuts, and they couldn't go in until the men finished and left.
Plus, Kate Bush's first show in 35 years, ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Alaska is probably not the first place that comes to mind when you think of Islam here in the U.S., but did you know that the Muslim community there is getting its very first mosque? Construction began in 2010, and it's finally getting close to completion. Heather Robertson Barber is a member of the Muslim community in Anchorage, where the new mosque is located. So tell us what this new mosque looks like, Heather.
Well, it's going to be a two-story building. The men will be in the prayer area on the first floor, and then the women will be on the second floor, and we'll have a balcony that we can overlook, so we can watch the man who does the sermon and leads the prayer. And but it'll be a little bit more private for the women. And then we're also in the second phase. We're planning school rooms, the offices, library, kind of like a church, you know, just the same thing. Basically, since we started, we've been renting a small storefront in a strip mall. It's not at all fancy, and we have literally outgrown it. And so this project has been in the works for quite a long time. It took us probably about 10 years to raise the money just for the land because we didn't want to take any loans. Muslims don't deal in interest, so we didn't want to take a bank loan. And so after about 10 years of fundraising, we were able to purchase the land. And like you said, in 2010, we broke ground.
I mean, in terms of design, some of the world's most beautiful buildings are mosques. Do you have any of the kind of details of inlay tile or any artwork that you're pretty proud of?
Well, we really don't because, like I said, it's taken us so long to raise the money just to build that we don't really have the extra money for the frills. You know, it's not going to be really fancy. We're not even going to have a dome. The weather has is a big factor in that. A lot of places in northern climates, they say they recommended don't put a dome on the mosque because it doesn't hold up the snow very well, and we get lots of that up here. So it'll have minarets, and you'll be able to tell that it's a mosque, but it's not going to be one of these, you know, it's not going to be like the Taj Mahal or anything like that.
Are there dictates in Islam for what a mosque needs to have in order to be a mosque?
Absolutely not. You could have a shed and make that a mosque. All it needs to have really is a clean floor, some place that you can pray. And, you know, that you could put your face on the ground and sit comfortably. But other than that, a mosque, it could be a living room. It could be anything.
Part of the reason that this new mosque was built is because the current mosque is too small and it's overcrowded. So how big is the Muslim community in Anchorage? I mean, what kind of places do they come from in the world?
We are an extremely diverse community. And I don't know that you will find a Muslim community like ours anywhere else because we have people from all over the world. We have from Southeast Asia, from South Asia, India, Pakistan, the Middle East, Europe, a lot from Africa. We even have Native Alaskans in our community and, you know, a lot of even just American converts. And so it's very different because when you go to a bigger city with a larger population, you might find that the Muslim communities kind of divide along background. You know, you'll find a Pakistani mosque, you'll find an Arab mosque, and a lot of times the culture from those places seeps into the workings, the daily workings. But we don't have that curse or luxury here. I don't know which it would be. I would say that I much prefer our community because, you know, if say an Arab tries to impose their culture, the Pakistanis will say, that's not Islamic. You have to go to the books. You have to research.
And Heather, what does this new mosque mean for you personally?
It will give us more of an identity, I think. You know, like when someone says, oh, I didn't know that there are Muslims in Alaska, we can say, yeah, the mosque is, you know, off of the Old Seward Highway and come visit. So this will, you know, we'll have the facilities. We won't have kind of a ragtag operation, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Heather Robertson-Barber is a member of the Muslim community in Anchorage. Heather, thanks very much for talking to us and telling us about this new mosque.
Thank you very much.
You don't necessarily need a big building to make your dream project a reality. For example, this next story is about one of the world's smallest museums, and it's open 24 hours. Can't beat that. Alina Simone explains.
I am standing in an abandoned elevator shaft, facing a shoe, a row of toothpaste tubes, and exactly 200 dead mosquitoes. At first glance, it's hard to understand what this stuff is doing in a museum, until you dial a toll-free number on your phone, punch in the code listed next to that shoe, and discover it's the very same
shoe thrown at President George W. Bush, Minister's Palace, Baghdad, Iraq, December 14th, 2008. Gift from Anonymous.
Museum, that spelled with an extra M on each end, brings new meaning to that old saying about one person's trash being another's treasure.
This is a collection of natural styrofoam rocks collected by Maya Ruth Lee, who is one day on a beach and bent over to pick up what she thought was a beautiful rock, and it turned out to be a piece of styrofoam.
This is Alex Kalman, one of Museum's founders.
And she realized now that discarded styrofoam and its erosion and decay over time is starting to kind of represent the new rock.
These new rocks, though shockingly artificial, are surreally beautiful. In a different museum, you might even call them art, but not this one.
The basic rules for curating our exhibits in museum is, first, that there's no art. There's nothing that is exhibited that was created merely to be appreciated as beautiful or as a piece of art. Everything must be vernacular.
Rule number two.
Nothing that is merely sentimental. There's no, this is the baseball glove that my grandfather gave me for my 12th birthday, because that's not revealing or meaningful about anything about the bigger picture. And what we're doing here is that we're looking at the bigger picture through the small things. We're looking at the macrocosm through the microcosm.
Like the microcosm of those mosquitoes, all 200 of them were killed mid-bite by Zachary Becker during a three-month stay in New Delhi. That chorus line of insect bodies gives you a much more visceral feeling of what enduring monsoon season must be like than a dry paragraph of wall text, just as a collection of censored pool toy packaging from Saudi Arabia gives you a literal sense of how the kingdom's religious strictures color everyday life.
So when the censors come and see that there are females in bathing suits on the packaging, somebody from the store has to then go and very meticulously sharpie over all the women. So there's a man in a Speedo holding hands with a big black blob, or a little child sitting in an inflatable tool being kissed by what looks like a big black blob slash creature.
I talked to the collector who loaned Museum the packaged pool toys, Madrid-born filmmaker Santiago Steely. Ironically, he was in Saudi Arabia to shoot a documentary about Saudi women in positions of power. But even a routine pit stop in Riyadh told a different story.
I remember being at a Dunkin' Donuts, you know, and all this group of little girls ran into the Dunkin' Donuts because they wanted to get some donuts, and they had to stop at the door because there were two men sitting next to me in the Dunkin' Donuts eating their donuts, and they couldn't go in until the men finished and left, and myself, right, until we all left the Dunkin' Donuts, they couldn't go in. So these three, like, 10-year-old girls were just like on the window of this Dunkin' Donuts, looking at the donuts, wanting the donuts, and they were just stuck there.
Donuts, pool toys, styrofoam, the international glue that holds us together, or at least helps us relate. There's got to be a universal maxim at work here, that the more a culture's snack food or toothpaste differs from ours, the more interested we get. And that's the magic of museum. It shows us just how exotic the stuff of everyday life can be. Just like the objects it houses, museum is easy to overlook. But once inside, I start to feel like the whole world is crammed into this tiny box. From North Korean snow globes to Japanese snack food to a collection of plastic spoons from around the globe. And even when it comes to trash, museum is seriously ambitious.
We hope to one day do an exhibition about space trash.
See? For New York's tiniest museum, not even the sky is the limit. For the world, this is Alina Simone. From New York.
Want to see that styrofoam rock or the vial of water from the bathroom next to the room where Leon Trotsky was murdered? We've got pics at PRI.org. Okay, I hope you still have an appetite because we're talking rice next, specifically rice in Vietnam. Vietnam cranks out a fifth of the world's rice exports each year, but there's a problem. Oceans are rising because of climate change, rising right up into some of Vietnam's richest rice-growing areas. Reporter Christopher Johnson went to find out what that means for farmers in the Mekong River Delta.
It's mid-season here in Sok Chang province. The fields are full, and under an easy monsoon wind, the crop rolls like massive emerald sheets. Out here with his rice, that's where Hai Thoc loves to be.
I so much enjoy working this land. Every day. I must come back here 4-5 times a day.
The 63-year-old farmer has been raising rice in this town since he was a boy. His parents did it. His great-grandparents, too. Thoc knows his crop.
When the rice gets sick, I'm sad too. I feel sad when the rice gets sick.
Squinting out across his acre-and-a-half plot, Doc reaches down into the sea of green rice plants and snaps off a long yellow leaf. Something's wrong.
I expect to lose some of the rice plants, to not be able to harvest them at all.
Doc says salt water's gotten into his fields, where it's harboring disease. He could lose nearly $300 this season, close to half of what he takes home in a year.
We're in Seopchang province. It's one of the poorest provinces in the Mekong Delta. And it's an area, you know, where for the most part, people are really dependent on rice cultivation.
Tim Gorman is a doctoral student researching how climate change is impacting the lives of people in this region. He says a warming planet is making rice farming very hard to sustain. Part of the problem is location. The whole area is veined by channels of the Mekong River. And just a few miles away, there's the South China Sea. That makes this part of the delta ripe for saline intrusion.
There's more and more salt water pushing up little streams and distributaries and also up the main channels of the Mekong River. You know, at times during the dry season, in the winter and the spring, it penetrates for dozens of miles inland.
In an ideal year, a delta farmer will get three good rice crops. But with less fresh water around, that's getting harder to do. In 2012, seawater had gone so far inland, there wasn't any fresh water to be found. Tuck and his neighbors, their fields full of green rice plants, had no good choices.
If we used no water, the rice would die. And if we used salty water, the rice would also die. We had to use salty water, and of course the rice died. We just needed 30 more days, and we would have harvested. But it all died.
Some of the farmers' troubles are certainly due to climate change and those rising sea levels. But maybe nobody should be growing rice here in the first place.
So right now where we're standing by this, you know, this beautiful rice field. But 100 years ago, we would have been standing in the middle of basically swamp, like tidal swamp.
It used to be that ocean water would naturally fill this region of the delta for at least some part of the year. It's only been in the last half century, Gorman explains, that the Mekong River Delta has become an intensive rice-growing area. First the French and then the Americans started major irrigation projects here. In some ways, Gorman says, saline intrusion is nature, with the help of a warming planet, undoing what man has built.
The part of it is with climate change is that it makes it increasingly difficult to sustain the infrastructure that was designed to protect this area from direct saline intrusion from the ocean itself, from the tides itself, is increasingly insufficient because the tides are simply higher.
For now, Gorman says, the state is trying to support and protect the rice sector. In the meantime, what choices do struggling rice farmers have? Barely a handful. One option, shrimp farming. About a dozen workers at this sorting facility are busy tossing locally raised shrimp into blue plastic drums.
Every night we work from 7 to 10 p.m., and we go through 2 to 8 tons of shrimp every day.
Hang Ti Dang helps run the place. She says this used to be a rice town. Now, she's seeing more and more people get into aquaculture.
If we can buy and sell shrimp, it's good for me.
And for shrimp farmers, even a small operation can earn more than 5 times what rice growers like Hai Tuck bring home in a year. But the shrimp business has its problems too. Startup costs are high, losses can be devastating, not to mention all sorts of environmental challenges. That debate doesn't matter much to Tuck. He doesn't have the capital or skill to grow shrimp. He's 63, most of his children have moved away, and he's got grandkids to help look after. So unlike other frustrated rice growers who are switching to shrimp or abandoning their farms altogether, Tuck is staying put.
I'm too old to leave here, and my land is here. So I will stay here to work on my land and let the young generation leave.
And he'll be here, his feet deep in the monsoon clay, watching the changes. I'm Christopher Johnson in the Mekong Delta in South Vietnam.
Christopher Johnson reports for Burn, an energy journal from Sound Vision Productions with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. The long-awaited return of Kate Bush, still ahead on The World from PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. More at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Yesterday, we paid tribute to movie director Richard Attenborough. He died on Sunday. We also talked about what an epic challenge Attenborough faced in 1980 to film Gandhi on location in India. Gandhi's funeral scene alone pulled 400,000 extras into the streets of New Delhi. Many Indians across the country worked on other scenes. One of those extras was Asim Chabra. Asim, what scene were you in?
I watched the film again last night. So there's one scene that comes up to the intermission when a train pulls up the railway station, which is the Sabarmati ashram where Gandhi had his ashram. And a number of important sort of dignitaries have come to visit him, some Indian politicians and this British woman who goes by the name of Meera Ben. You can actually see a glimpse of me sitting right by the train window. I still remember that we were told not to look at the camera, so you can see the side of my face and I'm sort of looking inside the train. And so that scene was shot over 2 days.
So how did you end up in Gandhi in the first place?
Well, it was actually very interesting. I was in a university, December of 1980, and it was very cold. The university I was there, Jawaharlal Nehru University in Delhi, there was a student strike on. I heard from some of my friends, the Gandhi team had set up their office at this 5-star hotel, which is called the Ashoka Hotel. It's still there in New Delhi. They were looking for extras. So they said, why don't you just go there with your passport size photograph? And I went with my younger brother. We were hired right there. I mean, essentially, they made us try some costumes. We wore these white kurta pajamas. And then they told us, you know, forget if the shoot was the next day or a couple of days later. But the most exciting thing was we were paid 75 rupees a day. It's like $1.25, really. So it means nothing, really. But back in 1980, so I'm talking about 34 years ago, that was a lot of money. So over a period of 4 days, I got 300 rupees. My brother got 300 rupees. And it was a lot of money I made, actually.
Yeah, not bad.
You know, we picked up our costumes the next day, like 6 in the morning at the hotel. And then the bus took us to this train station, which is outside Delhi, actually. It's a small town called Faridabad. You know, converting a train station from the 1980s into a train station from the 1920s or 30s, that requires a lot of production design. And they did a very good job in that.
Did you ever get a glance of Richard Attenborough himself?
Yes. So, you know, before the shoot started, and we were made to sit in the train, and because I was older, I went and sat by the window, and my brother couldn't argue with me. So, yeah, I saw Richard Attenborough right there. He was welcoming the actors, and he was very warm, very jovial. I don't know, he was probably in his 60s at that time, but he had a very father-like sort of a presence, this sort of round, warm guy with sort of gray hair. And the thing was, there were so many young actors from stage in Delhi, people who then eventually ended up having television careers or film careers. So I recognized many of those actors. And it was remarkable. They were all very, you know, it was almost like they were meeting a senior teacher of theirs or something. They were very respectful towards him, and he was very warm towards them. So I saw a little bit of that. I actually saw Ben Kingsley. He looked very authentic. I mean, he had, you know, they had aged him really well, and it comes across in the film also. It's very believable.
Asim, were you at the premiere in India when it came out in 1982?
No, I was in New York City. I saw it at the Ziegfeld Theater.
It at the Ziegfeld too when it came out. That's funny.
And it was in, I think, December of 82. I went with a bunch of my friends. You know, I can point myself because there are two very brief shots that you can see a side of my profile. And it was my major acting career as such.
What was that like when you saw yourself finally on screen after, much ramp up?
It came as a big shock. You know how big the screen is at Ziegfeld? It's like a huge
monster screen.
And to see myself, I mean, you know, I hear actors and how they get very conscious of seeing themselves. And I saw myself, it's so brief. But I watched the film a few times, including just last night I watched it again on Netflix. And it still comes as a shock as such. I was much younger then.
So now you're a film critic based in New York City. Now be objective. Gandhi, thumbs up or thumbs down?
I think thumbs up. I think the film still holds itself very well. That was a very interesting year in terms of the Oscars. There was E.T., there was Tootsie, there was Sophie's Choice. There was these major films. And, you know, I think Gandhi still stands the test of a time. I mean, it was done with so much love and regard and Respect for India, Attenborough's acceptance speech, which is on YouTube. I think everybody should watch that. It's such a wonderful tribute he pays to Gandhi, actually. And it was a great way for the world to discover this history of India and Pakistan also.
New York-based film critic and, for a few seconds, an actor in Gandhi, Asim Chabra. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Finally, I just want to give you ample notice that 1 month from today, we lose our director, April Peavy, who just last week shared with you and me her summer music choices. April is not leaving forever, though, but in her mind, the short trip she's taking is epic. Been months in the planning. She's headed to London, more specifically the Hammersmith Apollo, where British singer Kate Bush is performing. Now, this isn't just any show. It's one of 22 shows by Kate Bush there. The first one, tonight. This marks the first time the notoriously elusive Kate Bush is performing in 35 years. So if you're a fan, and there are many loyal Kate Bush fans, this is a no-miss. So, April, what is it about Kate Bush fans? Why are you so devoted?
Well, I will say, Marco, I may seem very composed and together on the outside, but inside, I am just totally doing backflips. And aside from the great music, the thing that I think a lot of the fans just love about her is she's there, and then she's gone. She releases an album, and then she goes away for around 5-6 years. She really does beat to her own drum. The best analogy I can give is, imagine if Madonna, the only tour that she ever gave was right after her Like a Virgin, which is in 1984, and she never performed again. Everybody who is a huge Kate Bush fan is just beside themselves, because we never would have expected her to give a tour. We were just totally blindsided.
Have you been in touch with other devoted fans who are traveling to London from overseas?
I certainly have. In fact, as soon as I purchased my ticket back in March, I went to Facebook and joined a fan page. And, Marco, it's incredible. I have in my hand 12 pages of fans traveling from outside the UK going to see the show. Saudi Arabia, Taiwan, Singapore, Israel, New Zealand, Romania, Poland, all across the U.S. and all across Europe.
Wow, what an international superstar still after 35 years of no concerts. I get the mysterious part of this, but why do you think Kate Bush waits so long to perform?
No one really knows. In fact, I don't know if you recall, but a couple of years ago I produced an interview. You actually spoke to Kate Bush. We had her on the program.
And remind us what she told us.
She said that she loves performing. She's not opposed to it, giving a concert. It's just basically one of those, like, time passes, and before you know it, it's like, wow, since 1979, since I last gave a show.
This is Kate Bush, and that was the World Show director, April Peavy. And we're taking a poll. Who would you most like to see stage a comeback concert? ABBA, Led Zeppelin, The Smiths, David Bowie? Let us know on Facebook. We have a poll going at facebook.com/PRI the world. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. RitaAllen.org, the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, the Annenberg Foundation, advancing a better tomorrow through visionary leadership today, more at annenbergfoundation.org, and by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.